Welcome to the 38th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. Recently, we traveled to Houston, Texas for a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal malignancies. At the meeting, faculty from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center and Baylor College of Medicine discussed the rapidly evolving landscapes of colorectal cancer, gastric GEJ cancer, pancreatic cancer, neuroendocrine tumors, and hepatocellular carcinoma. In patients with newly diagnosed metastatic colorectal cancer, the importance of performing molecular testing early on is paramount, as that information can be used to develop an effective treatment plan, said Kathy Eng, MD, FACP. Another important factor to consider in the frontline treatment of these patients is tumor sidedness, as data show that the location of a tumor can be used to inform which treatment should or should not be used in certain patients. In our interview, Eng, a professor of gastrointestinal and medical oncology in the Department of Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology of the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, provided an overview of the current treatment options available in patients and highlighted advances that have been made in the space.
The current landscape of colorectal cancer, there are a lot of different options, but the majority are still chemotherapy backbone-based. And I think that's important to keep in mind for patients. A lot of patients have a lot of interest in immunotherapy as a treatment option, but the reality is that patients that are eligible to receive immunotherapy in metastatic colorectal cancer is going to be less than 5% for the stage 4 patient population. So I would say that there's still the standard chemotherapy regimens such as FOLFOX and FOLFIRI. I would highly recommend FOLFOXIRI if your patient is well enough to receive treatment, has great performance status, and their laboratory tests are within normal limits. I think it's a good idea to be aggressive. I think it's also more important for the patient to understand, it is very important for a treatment-naive patient to know which side their original tumor is on, because that will help determine whether or not they would or would not benefit from anti-EGFR therapy. I think it's an exciting time, in all fairness. And then I think it's also very important for many oncologists to recognize the importance of molecular testing early on in the treatment instead of just waiting for third or fourth line chemotherapy, because you really have to think ahead. What's going to be your next step if the patient is intolerant of treatment or has an allergic sensitivity reaction? You just want to be having a strategic plan for your patients.
Michael Overman, MD, also stressed the importance of performing molecular testing in patients with metastatic colorectal cancer in order to identify subsets within the disease, as this information can have prognostic impact in terms of treatment. For example, knowing that a patient's tumor is microsatellite instability high tells oncologists that immunotherapy might be an effective treatment approach. In our interview, Overman, a professor in the Department of Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology of the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, discussed the role of immuno-oncology in the space and shared where future research should focus.
I think immuno-oncology in general is kind of exploding across the cancer space, right? So this is a colorectal interest, kind of any cancer interest. And so I think the questions are really kind of what potentially is the right combination to use. And so there's a lot of different resistant mechanisms kind of at play. And it does appear that in colorectal cancer in particular, we have a lot of stromal microenvironment factors that are kind of potentially hindering our success. So we do have a pretty rich macrophage and myeloid infiltrated kind of tumor environment. We do have T cells, right? So there's always been a lot of theory that we'd have success with immune therapy, but there appears to be something that's hindering those T cells from being active. And so a lot of the efforts are really starting to move out from PD-1 or CTLA-4, which are really T cell targeted therapies, to considering targeting some of the other tumor, other immune kind of subsets within that microenvironment, that tumor microenvironment. And so can you combine therapies that target myeloid cells or macrophages with kind of T cell targeting, and would that be a more successful effort? And so I think there's a lot of combination studies out there. I think the challenge is there's a lot of complexity to the immune system. And so there's a lot of different theoretical combinations and reasons to look at different combinations. And so we're still having a lot of challenge with our initial model systems, in the lab to really reflect patients. You know, in our lab model systems, we can get a lot of immune therapy activity in colorectal model systems, but doesn't correlate to the clinic. And so we're having trouble kind of modeling it well. And so there's a lot of efforts in the clinic based on more theory, but not a lot of good kind of model system-based evidence. And so we're still in a really kind of early exploratory phase. There's a number of trials ongoing looking at colorectal cancer. So my hope is that we're going to have some hints of activity, you know, from some new agents that are going to kind of potentially lead us down a path of success. You know, I think the agent that probably has the most kind of hints of activity that I've seen kind of recently is really kind of there's a bispecific antibody that targets CD3 and CEA. And so the idea is that this molecule binds a T cell, binds tumor, kind of brings those together, and then kind of generates an immune reaction by bringing those two forcefully together by the design of the molecule. And that's actually had some activity, you know, in early studies. There's been some toxicity kind of management issues, but that agent is moving forward. And so I do think there are some compounds that we have some hints of success, and I do hope over time we'll see some of those kind of panning out. But it is a bit frustrating when you look at other tumor types, you know, like melanoma or lung cancer, where you have, you know, this great PD-1 based response. And in microsatellite stable colorectal cancer, we don't have those agents right now. Really, I say there is no standard immune therapy option. Clinical trials, what you got to try. Often those are early clinical trials. You know, the only differential is really that if you have the microsatellite stability high, which should be tested in all colorectal cancer patients, then there is an immune therapy option.
Whether it's immunotherapy in colorectal cancer or chemotherapy in pancreatic cancer, Douglas A. Nelson, MD, told us that the common thread among these gastrointestinal malignancies has been the investigation of these agents in earlier settings. In our interview, Nelson, of the Department of General Oncology in the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, highlighted some of the key advances made in the treatment of patients with CRC and shed light on remaining challenges that still need to be addressed in this space.
Well, I think that certainly when we look at some of the smaller subsets, so when we look at the BRAF mutant patients, the Beacon study, I think there is a lot of excitement about that with the combination of an EGFR inhibitor with a BRAF inhibitor and a MEK inhibitor. Certainly, we're already using a somewhat similar combination or triplet targeting BRAF, but this is a little bit different because it incorporates the MEK inhibitor without chemotherapy, and the data from that are very encouraging so far. And I understand we may have data, you know, perhaps sometime later this year, and so I think that's exciting. And then looking again in the MSI high immunotherapy space, I don't think we're quite as far along, but again, I'm looking forward to seeing some of that data in earlier lines of disease and in combination with chemo, both in the advanced setting and now also we're seeing trials moving it into the adjuvant setting as well. And then finally, I think the idea of HER2 targeting is definitely an emerging thing in colorectal cancer. Again, it's these small little slices of the pie, you know, where we're talking about small groups of patients, but you add them all up and then you start talking about a significant minority of patients that we can try and treat them just a little bit differently, bring targeted agents in, often in combination with chemotherapy or by themselves, and sometimes see some really significant responses.
Jonathan Mizrahi, MD, also sat down with us to discuss how targeted treatments are helping to usher in individualized care in those with metastatic CRC. In our interview, he stressed that as more molecular subsets are defined and additional targeted therapies are developed, the importance of understanding the underlying genomic makeup of a patient's tumor is becoming increasingly important. Listen on to hear Mizrahi, a hematology oncology fellow at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, discuss key updates that came out of the 2019 GI Cancer Symposium, and how recent data is impacting personalized care.
You know, in colorectal cancer, a couple of the studies that I was a little bit interested in is, you know, one of them was looking at durvalumab and tremelimumab. So this was a study of PD-1 inhibition and CTLA-4 inhibition in a relapse refractory kind of, or I should say a refractory treatment population with colon cancer. And they looked at all comers, so it was irrespective of PD-1 status, MSI status. They saw that, you know, there was actually a PFS benefit in these patients who were treated with durvalumab and tremelimumab. You know, the PFS difference was small. It was not something I think everyone there got super excited about, but it's technically a positive study. So, you know, that was one thing everyone was looking at, and it would be interesting to see what the uptake of using the combination PD-1 and CTLA-4 inhibition will be in the general public, you know, if this does become approved based on this small benefit, but a significant one nonetheless.
Next, we sat down with Matthew H.G. Katz, MD, FACS, an associate professor in the Department of Surgical Oncology and the Division of Surgery at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. In our interview, Katz said that systemic chemotherapy with FOLFIRINOX should be the backbone of treatment of patients with localized pancreatic cancer who have undergone surgical resection. In our interview, Katz highlighted pivotal trials in pancreatic cancer and explained how these data are shifting the treatment paradigm for these patients.
So that is a very important study that randomized patients who underwent resection for pancreatic cancer to either systemic chemotherapy with gemcitabine or systemic chemotherapy with FOLFIRINOX. And the trial is important because it has the patients who received FOLFIRINOX in that study had the longest median overall survival duration really ever reported in any group of patients with pancreatic cancer, which was over 50 months, significantly longer than patients who received gemcitabine, which was only 35 months. So really, systemic chemotherapy with FOLFIRINOX is standard of care, I would say, for patients who undergo surgical resection as long as they can tolerate that therapy. There are issues in that regard because chemotherapy with FOLFIRINOX is a little bit harder to tolerate, or may be harder to tolerate in some patients than gemcitabine. Toxicity rates in that study were higher in patients who received FOLFIRINOX, and those are considerations that you need to take into account when selecting postoperative chemotherapy for your patient. I would also say that the inclusion criteria for that study were very important. So in that study, all the patients in that study underwent surgery, but all of them had a serum CA19-9 level that was less than 180. All of them had to have recovered completely from surgery, and have a good performance status following their operation. And none of them could have any symptomatic cardiac issues. And so really, I think that's a very super selected group of patients when you're talking about patients who have undergone major pancreatic resection.
Given the poor prognosis of pancreatic cancer and the steady stream of negative phase 3 trials, clinicians are facing an uphill battle in the treatment of this patient population. After taking the stage, the co-chair of the meeting, Shubham Pant, MD, sat down with us to discuss recent advances made in the frontline treatment of patients with metastatic disease. Pant is an Associate Medical Director of the Clinical and Translational Research Center, Associate Professor, Department of GI Medical Oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center.
Yeah, so the recent advances essentially have been the treatment of pancreatic cancer with FOLFIRINOX and the gemabraxane. So they've been going around for some time. So we haven't seen any recent breakthroughs, but in the last decade, those are the two frontline therapies which have taken center stage. Maintenance therapy is very interesting. So what we would do is, instead of FOLFIRINOX, if we give it for longer than 4 to 6 months, people start getting a lot of neuropathy, a lot of side effects. So the Prodigy study was good, in which it showed us that what a lot of people were doing in clinic, that if you give FOLFIRINOX for 4 months and then put in 5-FU leucovorin and add on the FOLFIRINOX at the time of progression, it really can help decrease the side effects and it can keep the survival the same. Now, this was a randomized phase 2 study, but still it showed us some of the ways in which we could mitigate the toxicities, keep the patient's quality of life going for some time.
Brandon Smaglow, MD, FACP, also sat down with us to discuss headway made in the treatment of gastric cancer, results from the Phase 3 TAGS trial, in which investigators evaluated the use of TAS-102 in heavily pretreated patients with metastatic disease, showed that the oral therapy is not only effective, but also has a manageable safety profile regardless of prior gastrectomy, said Smaglow, who was an assistant professor and medical director of hematology oncology at the Dan L. Duncan Comprehensive Cancer Center at Baylor College of Medicine. In our interview, Smaglow told us more about this pivotal study, which led to a February 2019 FDA approval, and highlighted other key studies in the space.
So TAGS was an interesting trial, largely because it was a study in the very late line treatment for gastric cancer, a third line of treatment or higher. In a lot of cancers, we do have multiple lines of therapy, but in gastric cancer, we've really focused a lot on first line and even only a little bit on second line. So to have a study that was really focused on that late line was very unique, and it turned out to be very important for the management of our patients. A couple things that I take away from that study. Number one, I think that the therapy that's used is a very easy therapy for many patients to tolerate, particularly when you're comparing it to doublet or triplet combinations of chemotherapy drugs. Also, it's a therapy that patients take as a pill. And so particularly for somebody who may have been on therapy for a year or more, having to constantly come in for infusions and deal with just the dregs of that back and forth, to be able to take a medicine at home and still get good oncologic care is really impressive. A couple things that I think really stand out about that trial, while the survival advantage was real, it was also pretty slight. But I think in the fact that it was so well tolerated makes it very attractive. So if for somebody to have perhaps a few months of a survival advantage with the therapy is oftentimes questionable, but to get that advantage and still have a very good quality of life, and in fact perhaps a contained or a maintained good quality of life, is very important, and that seemed to be demonstrated by the TAG study. So KEYNOTE-61 was a study that was looking to see if we could move the immune therapy pembrolizumab into the second line treatment space. We already have an understanding that we can use it in third line of therapy for select patients, particularly those patients whose tumors are what we call PD-L1 expressive. And KEYNOTE-61 was trying to move that into second line of therapy. KEYNOTE-61 used a comparator arm looking at a standard chemotherapy, in this case paclitaxel, in an effort to show that the immune therapy pembrolizumab might be better for those patients in that space. Now, unfortunately, it wasn't a positive trial, although there are some takeaways that might suggest that some patients benefited from pembrolizumab. Survival wasn't better, but the duration of response and the tolerability with pembrolizumab seemed to do better than the chemotherapy. The thing that I think we've learned from that study, though, that is very interesting, is that within that subset of patients who have a PD-L1 positive tumor, there actually may be gradations of positivity that may allow us to select, even within that subset, which subset are going to benefit from that therapy and which not. Specifically, those tumors that have, if you will, a higher degree of positivity of PD-L1 seem to benefit from the drug, whereas those who didn't had a lower positivity did not. That's very interesting. You know, we're talking about personalizing therapy, and so far what that has mostly meant is we check for some biomarker, either it's present or it's not, and that's the end of it. Now to be able to break that down and say, okay, the biomarker is present, but to what degree, and to be able to make treatment decisions based upon that is really revolutionary, and I think we'll see a lot more information from that study or from that approach in the near future.
Although there have been several therapeutic and research advances made in neuroendocrine tumors, perhaps the most exciting development has been the introduction of peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, according to Daniel M. Halperin, MD. In January 2018, the FDA granted approval to the radionuclide therapy Lutathera for the treatment of patients with somatostatin receptor-positive gastroenteropancreatic NETs based on positive findings from the Phase 3 NETTER-1 trial. In our interview, Halperin highlights the benefit of this approach and delves into the latest data to emerge in the field.
Yes, there have been a number of new developments in the field. Most recently, and I think most excitingly, is the development of PRRT, or peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, recently approved and available around the country this year. That's this new therapy where we basically use hormones to guide a nuclear smart bomb to the tumor and kill the cancer wherever it lives. And it actually reduced the rate of progression or death by about 80% in the randomized trial. The study was called NETTER-1, actually after the famous NETTER anatomy textbook for some reason. And essentially, patients who had midgut neuroendocrine tumors were randomized to the experimental arm with the nuclear therapy against a control arm of high-dose somatostatin analog therapy. And that was where we saw that improvement in survival, progression-free survival, about 80% or so.
We closed out the night by sitting down with Benjamin Leon Musher, MD, co-chair of the meeting, who shared how the treatment armamentarium for hepatocellular carcinoma has significantly expanded in recent years with the approval of several new agents such as lenvatinib, regorafenib, cabozantinib, nivolumab, pembrolizumab, and ramucirumab. In our interview, Musher, an associate professor of medicine, hematology, and oncology at Baylor College of Medicine, reflected on the progress made in HCC and highlighted promising combinations that are emerging in the space.
As of a couple of years ago, we only had one option for treating unresectable hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer. That was sorafenib. But in the last few years, several more drugs have gotten approved, targeted agents, a couple of immunotherapy agents, which makes the field very exciting. We still have a long way to go with this cancer, but we have several more options than we did even a few years ago. Options are good, but we also have to do a little more work to figure out what sequence to use them in.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 38th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to review the latest advances made in hematologic malignancies, register for the April 23rd State of the Science Summit in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We will also be holding a State of the Science Summit on genitourinary cancers on April 24th in Boston, Massachusetts. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.